book like 2 or 3 years ago.
Yeah.
I bought it in 2005, I think.
For a brief presentation on the two reports, overview on financial misconduct, and then have discussion. And when we're done, then have a presentation on the indebtedness of public servants, and then have discussion. I think we'd want to change that approach. We'll take it up from there. But before we start, we'll hand over to you, DG, and the PSC delegation to introduce themselves and the members to do the same, and then we'll get started.
Thank you, Honorable Chairperson and Honorable Member. I am Koku Mashiko. I am a commissioner for the Public Service Commission. Our chairperson, Professor Stan Sangweni, was not able to join us today because of other commitments. There is also a presentation that he is giving to the Portfolio Committee on Public Service and Administration. And later there's also something at the Western Cape Provincial Legislature. So you would appreciate that we had to share the responsibilities and I'm here representing the Commission for the two reports that you're presenting. The presentation, gentlemen, is going to be one. We have combined the presentation, unless if you so choose that you have the first presentation on the financial misconduct report, and then later the report on the indebtedness of the public servants.
No, it's fine. We can leave it as well. Okay.
Yes, we are very grateful for this opportunity to come and present the two reports to yourself.
But can we want it to... We know who you are, but who else is with you? We're saying introduction so that members will also introduce themselves so you know who you are talking to before we go into the actual business of
the day. Thanks. I'm here with the Director General of the Public Service Commission, Ms. Odette Ransom, and also Ms. Caroline Mankuru, who is the Chief Director of Public Administration Investigations, as well as Ms. Fini Viviat, who is the Chief Director of Special Operations.
Okay, then it's your turn to know the members who are here. I'll start on the, I don't know whether extreme right. Yeah, I'll start with you here.
Okay. I'm Eddie Chase, Scott.
Caroline, who is our Chief Director for Public Administration Investigations, will actually take us through those two reports, and then collectively we will engage on some of the themes arising out of those reports. Thank you.
I'm told we must talk directly to the mic. even if the noise is stopped.
Thank you. This is the outline of the presentation, honourable members. I will deal with the introduction and the reporting on financial misconduct, and then the statistical overview on financial misconduct for the 2006-07 financial year. You will note that in respect to the financial misconduct overview, there would be no recommendations, and that is as a result of the fact that we, as the PSC, only do a report every second year, a full-on report. And what the other year then would be an overview, which would not then cover recommendations. We look at the trends, and we still inform the trends and compare them from the time that we started. So we'll deal with the trend analysis on financial misconduct cases since the inception of the reporting period, and that is the 2001-2002 financial year. Then we'll deal with the indebtedness of public servants.
We're just waiting for a book for Keshwin to sign, then the noise will stop. Just to give our mind.
Thank you. And then I will deal with the statistical overview and analysis on the issue of microlending, and then I will move on to the statistical overview and analysis which will relate to garnishee orders, the implication of indebtedness for the public service, and the recommendations dealing with indebtedness. At the end, then, I will deal with the parallels that can be drawn between the two reports and make some concluding remarks. As you are aware, since 2001, the PSC on an annual basis has been reporting financial misconduct in the public service. The reports that we've generated focus on cases of financial misconduct reported to the PSC in terms of the Public Finance Management Act and the Treasury Regulations. So this presentation will cover the report on financial misconduct for the 2006-07 financial year. So through this tracking then, this systematic tracking of financial misconduct in the public service. The public service commission became interested in finding out how the ability of public servants to manage their personal finances impacts on the whole issue of financial misconduct. As a result, the commission then commissioned a study into the issue of personal financial management, and we investigated the indebtedness of public servants. So this presentation, as I said, will also look at the indebtedness of public servants. So while these two reports are independent of each other, they do complement each other, and there is we reflect on the correlation between reported financial misconduct cases in the public service and the personal financial debt of public servants. You will see, honourable members, that there's a link, a notable link from the trends that are in the financial misconduct report that are reinforced by some of the findings that you will see in the report on indebtedness. While such trends may not be surprising given that the ability to manage financial resources requires competence in financial management, an ability to manage finances effectively and efficiently, and financial and planning. So any doubts on the ability of public servants to manage their own resources creates then the uncertainty on the trust of level, the level of trust, the honesty and the integrity with which they will manage departmental finances and answers. The PSC has got a broad mandate, and among the things that we do, we are authorized to investigate and evaluate the organization, administration, and personnel practices in the public service. So we are empowered then to monitor and evaluate financial misconduct in terms of the PSMA. If we look at what financial misconduct entails, then we will see that it entails material losses through criminal conduct, unauthorized irregular, fruitless, and wasteful expenditure. And in terms of the PFMA and the Treasury regulations, the accounting officer, as soon as the disciplinary process are completed, then report to, among others, the PSC on the outcome of the cases, and they would report on things such as the name and the rank of the officials against whom the proceedings were instituted, the charges indicating the financial conduct the official is alleged to have committed. They would report on the findings and the sanctions that are imposed on the official, and any other further action that are taken against the official, and those could include criminal or civil proceedings. The primary objective of us reporting on financial misconduct is really to provide our stakeholders with an in-depth statistical overview and analysis of the information that is reported to us by the National and Provincial Departments on financial misconduct for a particular year. And then annually, then, how we go about it is we address a circular to the heads of all national and provincial departments, and then we request them to report finalized cases of financial misconduct according to the fields that I've just alluded to in a moment ago. It is notable then that since the introduction of the reporting requirements on financial misconduct in the PFMA and Treasury regulations, in this year, this financial year, it's the first time that all national and provincial departments have reported to the PSC. That is an improvement from previous cycles, so it's the first time that we have a 100% compliance. And of the 35 national departments that we have, 14 departments have indicated that they have no finalized financial misconduct cases in the particular financial year. Of the 107 provincial departments, 47 departments indicated that they finalized no financial misconduct cases in the particular year. For us, that begs the question that those 14 and those 47, does it mean that they really do not have cases of financial misconduct, or are the systems and processes and the internal control so lax that where there are instances of financial misconduct, then they go undetected? But then there's also the possibility that really there is no financial misconduct that has occurred. The overview on financial misconduct, we first look at the information reported in the financial year 2006-07. Then after that, we will look at the trends, analysis of the information reported in the previous cycles going back to 2001-2002, when the reporting started. If we start looking at the steps, honorable members, there are 1,042 cases of financial misconduct that were reported in the 2006-07 financial year. That is the distribution in terms of where the cases find themselves. As you can see, there are 370 at national level and 672 at provincial level. If we look at national level, in terms of who are the highest, the department with the highest number of cases, we see that the Department of Justice and Constitutional Development has reported a number of 197 cases, and is followed by the Department of Defense. Again, it begs the question, do they have more rigorous mechanism for checking this kind of offenses, is that okay, or does it mean that there's a certain culture that, you know, exists within those departments, and the securities and the internal processes are lax, and then they find themselves being at that level of financial misconduct. If we turn to provincial level, the Western Cape got 299 reported cases, and it's followed by KZN at 125. Looking at the types of financial misconduct, I've already given a broad description of what financial misconduct entails. But if we look at what the breakdown in terms of what are the types of cases that we're dealing with here, we'll see there's 8 corruption cases, financial mismanagement at 67, gross negligence at 85, misappropriation and abuse at 107, 131, theft at 136, and fraud at 615. Honorable members, I want to draw your attention to the fact that your highest or the type of financial misconduct that is prevalent is theft and fraud. And those obviously have criminal connotations. And I would like you to pay particular attention to the slide where I talk about reporting on criminal action or civil action that is taken after the internal disciplinary cases have been finalized. If we're dealing with a scenario where theft and fraud are at the highest, then that must inform the level at which criminal cases or civil action is taken, because theft and fraud have criminal connotations, unlike negligence or financial mismanagement, if I can take those examples. So as I've already drawn that to your attention, cases in the category fraud comprise of and theft comprise a significant portion, and that is 59% of the overall cases that have been reported. We look also at the level of employees that are charged with financial misconduct. You will be comforted, members, to note that at level 16, that is the people that are the accounting officers, that no cases of financial misconduct, but your HODs, your DGs there. At level 16, we do not have. The problem or the levels where financial misconduct seems to be manifesting itself, if you look at that graph, you will see it is at 11, 1 to 8. And I might just note that this trend has been coming through the years. If we look at then the outcome of financial misconduct cases, you will see that a bigger proportion of people that were charged with financial misconduct were correctly charged, in that they were found guilty. So 83% were found guilty, 7% the cases were withdrawn, 85% there would be a resignation, 4% would be not guilty, and in 1% there would be instances of a contract expired or people that retired or got deceased while there were cases pending against them. We take a moment now to look at the sanctions that are imposed in cases of financial misconduct for the 2006-2007 financial year. You will see that the 47 of written warnings, suspension without pay standing at 76, the discharge rate is there at 158, and whether the combination of sanctions, there are the figures. And you will see that we have more of final written warnings. So final written warnings have constituted 36% of the sanctions that are imposed after the findings of not guilty. And discharge was imposed in 18% of the cases. Now, if you look at that and consider that a good proportion of that would have been comprised of theft, fraud, and corrupt theft, what are the steps saying to us? Looking at the figures now, financial misconduct has financial implications for the public service, and the total cost in respect of unauthorized, irregular, and fruitless and wasteful expenditure and losses resulting from criminal conduct reported by departments and provinces for the 6-7 financial year, these are the amounts. At national level, we look at that amount, and on the next column, you will see the amount that is recovered. And those are the figures in terms of provincial, and we say which of those amounts have been recovered. This is a very interesting slide. We look at the criminal proceedings instituted against employees charged with financial misconduct. You will note, honorable members, in 22% of the cases, there's no criminal action taken. In 25% of the cases, there is criminal cases that have been taken. In 30% of the cases, departments did not bother to indicate whether criminal cases have been instituted or not. And in 15%, criminal cases would not be applicable. There, those 15% would comprise of cases of negligence and misappropriation, which do not, by their nature, constitute criminal conduct. So when it appears that the state has suffered losses or damages through criminal acts or possible criminal acts or omissions, the matter must be reported in writing to the accounting officer and the staff. And that is in terms of the treasury regulations. So there are mandatory reporting requirements. And as I said, not all acts of financial misconduct would, by their nature, then require that criminal action be taken. If we look at the numbers of employees, there's been a significant increase in the number of cases reported to the PSC for the 2006-07 financial year when we compare that to the previous financial years. That graph shows the rate or the numbers that have been reported through the years. You will see that from the previous cycle where we were standing at 771, we now in the 6-7 financial year are dealing with 1,042 cases of financial misconduct. And the most significant increases were in Gauteng, KwaZulu-Natal, and the Western Cape. The Eastern Cape and Mpumalanga provinces had substantial decreases in the number of cases, and the Eastern Cape, those are the figures. If we look at the trends then since the 2001-2002 financial year, and we look at the increase in the cases in the categories fraud and theft, I've mentioned that those are the highest, the categories where we've got more financial misconduct. The increase in the number of cases in the category fraud can be largely ascribed, though, in the cycle, the high number of social grant fraud cases reported by the department. This graph then shows the trend analysis of financial misconduct cases reported since the 2001 financial year, and it speaks to our SMS members, that is your management cadre now within the public service, and we worried about the high percentage of SMS members that are charged with financial misconduct. If you look at the ratio in terms of the numbers that are employed in that in those ranks, and you look at the numbers of financial misconduct, there is a clear disconcerting trend there. As you will see, where the SMS members lie in comparison to the other levels throughout the financial years from 2001-2002. In the current cycle, we're sitting with about 15 of those. Moving on then to the withdrawal of cases and findings of guilty. In the 2006-07 financial year, the highest number of employees, that is 83%, were found guilty following charges of financial misconduct. During the 2006 financial year, 6-7 financial year, a substantial number of cases were withdrawn, 7% that is, or the employees were found not guilty, and that is standing at 4%. This could possibly be ascribed to the lack of expertise on the part of departments to deal with allegations of financial misconduct effectively. This trend is in keeping with the observations made in the PSC report on the measuring of the effectiveness of the National Anti-Corruption Hotline, where the PSC indicated that investigative capacity in departments appears to be limited. We look here at the decline in discharge from the public service and appropriate sanction. If you look at the nature of financial misconduct, you would agree that it is by its nature serious charges, and there's been a a decline in discharge as an appropriate sentence in cases of financial misconduct. And that is represented through the years. If you look at the 2003, for instance, financial year, where discharge, where people have been found guilty of financial misconduct, were standing at 46.6, and you compare that with now, the 6-7 financial year, you would see that there's been a huge decline. And the question, it begs the question then, are we becoming more tolerant, or is the public service becoming more tolerant of financial misconduct, and people will no longer be discharged if they find themselves guilty of financial misconduct? The cost of financial misconduct, there is also an increase in the cost of financial misconduct. The total cost of unauthorized, irregular, and fruitless and wasteful expenditure and losses resulting from financial misconduct is set out in that table below. And as you can see, honorable members, in the financial year 2006 and 2007, we're sitting at over 130 million. And if we compare that with when financial misconduct started being reported, you know, in 2001, when the compulsory reporting started, there has been a substantial increase. So if we look at it in terms of percentages, there's been a significant increase, that is 186% in the cost of financial misconduct if we look at the 2005-06 and 2006-07 financial year. But we put that in perspective for you by indicating that this increase is largely ascribed to two cases which involve very large amounts. And this would be the cases of 16 million in the National Department of Agriculture and 60 million in the Department of Roads and Public Transport in the Limpopo province. So the latter two comprise 58% of the total cost of financial misconduct. So although there's that high or significant increase of 186, a portion of that can be ascribed to the fact that there's been those cases that constitute 58% of the total cost. Let us look at the recovery then. The rate of recovery of the value of the loss and the damage as a result of financial misconduct in the public services in 2005 and 2006 and 2007 has been very low. So what happens is then, what that means, honorable members, is that once people have been found guilty, there would not be criminal charges instituted, there would not be civil processes put in place to, and that in terms of the PSMA is one of the duties or responsibilities of an accounting officer. There has been an increase in the overall rate of recovery. That is from 9.5 to 22.1, but that is still a very low rate of recovery. And this figure is well below the overall recovery rate, which was in 2004 financial year, which was at about 50.3. But having said that, it has to be kept in mind that at the time the departments are required to report to the PSC on the outcome of the disciplinary process, there might be several processes that are put in place for the recovery of that money, but those processes are not controlled by the department, are run by the court, so they might take longer, and therefore the reporting might be affected in that they might not necessarily then have to collected as soon as the disciplinary process has been finalized. So it is of importance then that department accelerates the rate of recovery to show their commitment to service delivery and that they take effective and appropriate steps to collect all money due to the department. As I've indicated before, there's a lack of information on criminal proceedings that have been undertaken by department in cases of financial misconduct. That table then speaks to that issue. And if we look, I will look at the outermost year and then go to the current year. In 103, looking at the 2002-03 financial year, there was no criminal action taken in respect of 87, and in respect of 103 cases, it was not indicated whether criminal steps have been taken or not, action has been taken or not, and then in 173, criminal action was taken, and in 554, there was no criminal action taken. If we look then at the 6-7 financial year, we will see that 157, those were the cases where criminal cases could not be applicable, and 400 cases, there was just no indication from department what had happened, and criminal action was taken in the presence of 257, and no criminal action was taken in the presence of 222, 58 cases. So as I said, similar to the 5-6 financial year, criminal proceedings were instituted in 25% of the finalized financial misconduct cases reported in the 2006-07 financial year. So overall, since the 2002-03 financial year, the percentage of cases in which department has instituted criminal action, that is 31%, as compared to the total number of cases, that is relatively low. And due to the fact that departments fail to provide adequate information in this regard, we're not in a position to adequately determine the trends or the specific reasons for not instituting criminal action. As I said, there's a good proportion where department personnel never indicated. Now, looking at the credibility and accuracy of the information, what we have developed is we've developed a template upon which we ask departments to say, this is the format, this is the reporting format in which we would like you to report these cases of financial misconduct. But some departments, once again, fail to comply with the reporting format, and they then would submit insufficient information. And this information, when we look at it, we're quite convinced that it's not quality checked. So in order to improve integrity, data integrity, we made follow-up inquiries and we had to phone departments, and this also then delayed the completion of the report. Accounting officers should take responsibility to ensure the timeliness, accuracy, and credibility of information provided to us. That then would be the part dealing with financial misconduct. We looked at the steps and what the suggests to us. So I'd like to move on now to the next case, the issue of debt and debt to public servants.
Yeah, maybe, although we agreed at the beginning, but I'm not sure if this was what pleasant for us to get posed the question. Let me just add that we got to the noise. Went to the foreman's office, we were sent to phone one patient who went to Parliament to get permission who have refused because stoppages cost Parliament money, so we must either bear the noise or find another venue. That's the advice. And the same politicians run the country. Right. Let's stop here and let's maybe take questions or comments. Questions on this first part. Rapule and honorable friends, please let's talk to the mic, not because of the noise, but I think the system requires it for purpose of recording. So let's talk directly to the mic. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. I just want clarity on the two documents. There is one document that we got yesterday, and this new document. Just want the reconciliation.
No, the one you got yesterday, we did it ourselves in-house.
Pardon?
The one you got yesterday, we did it ourselves in-house.
Oh, but the information doesn't seem to be the same on one line.
No, let's use the information we got today. Or anyway, let me hear you.
Why don't you hear what I'm trying to say?
That's what I've just said. Let me hear you.
And then say, ignore it after asking, please. Yeah, this one says, of 35 national departments, only 14 indicated that they had no financial misconduct. This one says, no financial misconduct were finalized. So, should I presume that there are financial misconduct? This one is wrong. Is that what I should assume? Do you get my...
Yes, I do. I get your point.
Yeah, I just got reconciliation. I want us to say this one should be ignored, I mean officially. I shouldn't labor that impression that information is not the same. Of 35 national departments, only 14 indicated that they had no financial misconduct cases for the financial year. They indicated that they had no financial misconduct cases for the financial year. Now, the recent one says, of the 35 national departments, 14 departments indicated that they finalized no financial misconduct cases in the particular financial year. I still contend they don't give me the same meaning. So that is why I say, should I assume that the one that says there are no financial misconduct should be ignored? I want confirmation.
The confirmation is that 35 departments were surveyed for that year. Of the 35 departments, all 35 departments responded to the Public Service Commission. And of those 35 departments that responded, 14 of those 35 departments said that they had no finalized financial misconduct cases for that year. I hope that clarifies.
No, I think the question that is asking is, if you say they have no finalized cases, it might mean that they have cases that are still in process. Now, if you say they have no cases, it means that there was none at all. So he wants clarity and reconciliation of the two.
What he's saying is that there were no finalized cases for that year. So if the cases are still pending, cases will only come in the following year. Remember, the regulatory requirement is that cases that are only finalized must be reported to the Public Service Commission. So when we talk about finalized cases.
Right, Honorable Trent.
Okay, just to follow on from Mr. Kula, I have a few questions. I'll be as quick as I can. My first question has been answered, so therefore the requirement is not to report on cases in the pipeline, only that it's been finalized. If that's been done in the PFMA, I don't seem to find anything there. It just says that the planning officer must take effective and appropriate steps. So maybe we should just look at those requirements.
Okay, so that's right out of regulation.
Okay. Now, then going from that, you know, you made the point, and to me it's very important. How reliable are the stats at this point in time? I mean, you've been doing it for a few years. I don't know to what extent you're getting cooperation, but it does concern me that you could look at some of these statistics in completely opposite ways. You could say there's better control, or you could say, well, they weren't reporting in the past, or they weren't doing anything. So you know, that to me, how do we really unpack that? And obviously, there would be differences between different departments and provinces and, you know, et cetera. And so I'm just concerned. I'm sure that there's a pattern developing which has got to help us. But then I come to the other remark that in the presentation, which concerned me, is that despite all of this, over the past years, there's been a decline in people that are actually discharged. And I think that was mentioned. Now, that concerns me. And then when you couple that to the other comment that was made, which is to me very important, in that the major incidences take place between levels 1 and 8. And then you look at the senior management and middle management, you say, well, there are not many cases there. But my question is, could it not be a lack of proper management processes and procedures that create the opportunities at lower levels for the corporation? So I think we must be careful not to just blame the people at lower levels. Your management is responsible for putting in proper procedures and processes in place to actually prevent fraud and corruption and theft and all these things. So you know, I think it's far more complicated than what meets the eye. And I would just like you to tell us, I really believe the work you're doing is very important because it gives one a basis to look at these things. So therefore, my question really is, do you interact with the departments on all of this information and say, no, right, where is the problem? Are we finding solutions to it? And if so, are you getting positive responses from it? So that's the one question. The other one is just very short. You know, I'm aware of the fact that there are 4 so-called closed accounts. That's the National Intelligence, SSS, Special Defense Account, and the police have a crime intelligence account, which is supposed to be closed accounts. Now, those audits are done, and they're given to the JSCI to look at. Now, my question is, would any misconduct in those accounts, because of the secret sort of nature of them, would any of those misconduct cases be reported to you? Or not? Was that outside of the ambit of your, what you do?
All right. Thank you. Who's here?
Thank you, Chair. Chair, I'd like to ask a question on page 12, 13, and 14, and it relates to the various provinces, especially the Western Cape, which it's a pity one didn't have the numbers for. Well, I suppose it is available somewhere in the report, but if you look at the various departments of the provinces, in, for instance, the Eastern Cape and KZN and the Western Cape, a lot of cases of financial misconduct are in the education department, especially the Western Cape, which has 193 cases, which is by far the highest of all the other provincial departments. And one would like to know what is the reason for this increase, and what is the typical, I know you've got the list of financial misconduct or types of financial misconduct, but what specifically are the issues in, for instance, the Western Cape Department of Education that makes it so high, and also relating to the other two provinces which are so high? And then I'd like to ask, if I may, on page 23, on page 23 and on the top of page 24, you have the cost of the financial misconduct reported at national level. And In many cases, they have the figure there, which is the cost, and then also how much they've actually recovered. But a couple of departments, not a single cent have been recovered. For instance, communications, there was 4 million, nothing's been recovered. Foreign affairs, 13 million, nothing recovered. And so you can continue on the top of page 24 as well. With these zero amounts that have been, that have not been recovered, would that specifically mean one case, or is there a reason why there are no recovery in these departments at national level? I'll stop at this stage. Thank you, Chair.
And I hope you are welcome. It includes the Public Service Commission itself. 90 million amount recovered, zero. Yeah. I always deal with figures in millions in the comment. Okay, can we respond to those two and then we'll turn over to another?
Okay, my colleagues will assist, but let me start with some of the quick questions. I think the first question was really about how reliable are the statistics. And what the Public Service Commission is saying is that we have problems around the data integrity. If you look at the report, the issue about the incomplete information we get and the poor quality of that information we get is of concern to us. And that's why we feel that accounting officers should take a much more deeper interest in the information that is submitted to the Public Service Commission. Our concerns were such that once we had received the information with regard to the department, we started a process where we started phoning up the individual department to try and verify the information. Because in some cases, we saw an element of laziness. In other words, the kind of form they filled in last year was exactly the same form they gave us the next year. But because our document tracking is so effective, we were able to pick up these issues. So really the nature of our research has to continuously deepen in order to ensure that our data integrity is improved. We cannot say that it's basically 100% accurate. It's 100% accurate in terms of the information we receive and how we analyze that. But in terms of the information given by the department, I think I wouldn't be very comfortable putting my head on the block for that. That I can't say for sure it is completely accurate. But I think what you must accept, that this tracking has started taking place from 2001. So while there may be some inaccuracies around the figures, I think the trends themselves are fairly accurate in terms of what it is showing through. So, you know, and the more we tighten up that kind of accuracy, I'm sure the trends in some cases will even deepen and we'll be able to pick up even more trends.
But what would be the basis for incorrect figures? I'm trying to say maybe we're dealing with something that you know we do need to pause a little bit. You have officials, if somebody is employed, is required to provide information, and they provide information that you yourself cannot put your head on the block about. I mean, what is it communicating to us about either the quality or the mindset of the people who are running our department or holding certain positions of responsibility?
Obviously, the one extreme is really an extreme of complete laziness on the part of officials to ensure that they provide correct information. I think a much more concerning trend that we've experienced is the levels at which people are required to complete this information. And therefore, by the time the information comes to us, you may have a situation where senior management has not cast their minds on the information or has not even bothered to cast their minds on the information. So I think it's an element of all of those issues that are of concern. And as a result, the PSC has to use quite a bit of resources to try and verify the kind of information that is given.
There were questions posed by committee.
The issue in relation to there has been a decline in people discharged. and the level of level 1 and 8, I think, and then, of course, the connection with proper management and internal control. I think the one thing you must appreciate about this tracking of the Public Service Commission, primarily the objective of such tracking at this stage is to develop some kind of statistical, factual overview of what is really happening. I think the kind of deeper analysis you're speaking about, as we grapple with the data and with the information each year, I think that kind of deepening will also necessarily happen. Because I think you're very correct. While factually the statistical trend shows that levels 1 to 8 are your problem areas, you've got to start asking much more probing questions in relation to how these levels are being supervised and how are they being monitored, and is this rigorous enough? And I think I agree with you that the report has not necessarily gone through that kind of analysis, if you would. But as was explained by the presenter, we, on an annual basis, we actually give a statistical overview. And on a biannual basis, we give a much more comprehensive report where we try to probe these kind of correlations and connections. And in that kind of report, we also provide recommendations, which we hope the department will take up. But I think the point is well taken in relation to that correlation. I think my colleagues will talk about the issue around the closed accounts, the actual researchers, and also the issue around the Department of Education. And in relation to the fact that some departments have not recovered the money, if you see the two columns, I think you've got to appreciate this here in that the information that they're giving covers a particular year, well, 12-month period. And in some cases, you would have a situation where that kind of misconduct or that kind of case may have only been finalized in March of the financial year. And therefore, when they give the information to the Public Service Commission, the processes for recovery have not even started because they will only then start in the April of the next financial year. And that comes to the situation of the Public Service Commission case. We had a situation of an official in the Limpopo area where there was gross negligence in relation to a loss of a computer. We therefore, from the April of the year following, we've been deducting a certain amount from it. So in terms of the report following this year, you will be able then to see what has been the rate of recovery in respect of that. It would have been impossible to of us to start recovering in that particular year because we only finalized the case in March. And the case was finalized within the 30-day requirement. It was recovered in February, it was finalized in March, recovery starts in April, which will only then be reported in the next financial year. That is the case with some of the departments. I'm not necessarily saying it's the case with all the departments, because one of the reasons we put such a focus around recovery, if you look in the first beginning of our investigation into this area, we were not really focused on the recovery rate. More and more we're deepening the focus around the recovery rate.
So would it be that for those departments that have made recovery, it will be, I mean, the total amount are not the amounts that were accumulated in a single year. It is a multi-year figure whose recovery would, when would the recovery have started? I'm looking at it in relation to the one case that you gave of the PSC.
In which we've done the recovery for the 2006-2007 year. If you just go to that slide around recovery, just so we can make the point around it. The slide we chose in the amount of money, the losses incurred. And my team will correct me, but what has happened in this particular year, that amount recovered is the amount that was recovered for the 2006-2007 year in relation to financial misconduct that happened in 2006-2007.
2001, if you take the collective amount, right up until, for instance, the current year, how much is really need to cover. But in this particular case, that recovery is the effect of finalized misconduct claims also for the 2007 year.
I'd like to welcome members of the Public Account Committee from the Republic of Ireland. We eagerly await your arrival. You are actually welcome.
Grant fraud that were reported in the Western Cape provinces, in the Western Cape province, and those cases find themselves within the Department of Education and Department of Health. So that's the high number of cases at the Department of Education.
Sorry, I missed that, but I mean, what your examples that you've mentioned now, that's not really. What specifically in the Department of Education are the types of financial misconduct that makes it so high?
As I said, Honourable Member, it's social grant fraud, so it is fraud in this instance.
But social grants in the Education Department?
Yes, Chair. What would happen is that people would acquire social grants where they're not entitled to them, and that would constitute fraud, and those people would be within the Department of Education.
Actually, be to explain it, would be teachers who would perhaps be claiming a disability grant, social grant, or a pension grant, and yet they're not entitled to it. The reason why these are being so detected is really the focus then that is being placed on trying to uncover the levels of social grant. I suppose if you pick another particular area, you possibly, if you get that kind of focus in a given year, you probably also see a spike. So it's really teachers that are basically saying they're entitled to a disability grant or using their IDs to claim a social grant, which they're not entitled to.
Yeah, I agree with you. Thank you very much, Chair. But I think it might actually be misleading or put a bad light on the Department of Education, because they're actually defrauding the Department of Welfare and not the Department of Education. That's why when I saw this high number in the Education Department, I thought, yo, you know, it looks a bit weird. May I just, on that issue, thank you very much for this investigation. I think it helps us all a lot. But what I would like to know, maybe it's available, it will be interesting to get a layout of, you've mentioned all the various types of financial misconduct, the telephone calls, the misuse of the government vehicle, petrol, all this stuff. But if you look at all the cases, to actually get a breakdown of actually what items are the most popular forms of financial misconduct, and in a way to see if one can't address that.
Vincent? Thank you. Thank you, Chair. Maybe just to follow up on what Pierre said just now. I think, Chair, we as a committee must recognize that this is not an end in itself. It's actually a means towards an end, and it assists us in our own.
And try the other one. I think that one seemed to be a bit.
Thank you, Chair. Is it better? Yeah. Chair, I was saying that maybe we should welcome this report because it will assist us. And therefore, to follow on what Pierre was saying, it would be helpful for the Commission to be able to give us this report by department. You see, because we're the ones that do the oversight. When the Department of Health comes to us, if we had a report that says, in the Department of Health, these were the cases that were recorded, and these were the actions. It helps us to deal with them individually. That's just a comment that I wanted to make. But the question specifically that I wanted to ask clarity on, I'm not sure if I misheard the presenter. I understood you to be saying that where there's recovery, that is the end of the action. I thought that's what I understood. Because there was recovery, we didn't do anything. We wrote a final letter or something. Now, in a case of fraud, whether there's recovery or not, my understanding is that that person must go to jail if he's guilty. So I just want clarity on that. Is the practice where we recover, that's the end of the action? Especially taking into consideration that you're saying that fraud was the major cause of it. My understanding would be if there's corruption, it should be dealt with. The second point maybe, and then maybe it will dovetail into my first question. You know, your report says 1,042 cases. It's more useful for us if you said that equates to so many individuals. Because cases doesn't necessarily mean individuals. It would help us if you said in the public sector 1 million public servants are guilty, or 2 public servants are guilty. Because then we can make more sense of the 83% that you're talking about. The final question that I'd want to ask on this one, Chair, is, you know, I don't understand. We are saying there 36% were given final written warning. Now, does that 36% exclude those that were found guilty of fraud or theft? Because my first question is, if there's fraud or theft, then a final written warning is an inappropriate sanction, in my view. You can't give me a final written warning if I'm guilty of fraud. So just give us clarity on those ones. And like I said earlier today, I'm not sure how possible it is, but if the Commission could give the committee by department, certainly the national department in the first instance, if you could break down these reports of yours by department and give it to us for our own record when we meet departments, it would be very useful. Thank you, Chair.
Yeah, thank you, comrades. And piggybacking on the point you are raising, fraud cases constitute well over 55% of the cases. But if you look at the cases where criminal charges have been laid, it constitutes 25%. I think there is a disequilibrium there, if our understanding is correct, that fraud is a criminal offense. I wonder whether you have noted that, and what has been your response in terms of feedback going back to departments. Yeah, maybe you can respond, then I'll give other members to question.
Okay, yeah. Thank you, Chairperson, and thank you, Honourable Member, for the questions and the comments. Just starting with the first question and then maybe linking it to the last question. In terms of where there is recovery, does it mean that is the end of the case? You would notice that, as you have correctly indicated, the issue of criminal charges that needs to be preferred against individuals, you have different kinds of categories of financial misconduct. Where you have misappropriation or negligence, these cases do not warrant, you know, criminal proceedings to be taken. However, in cases where there is a fraud and theft, you would have over and above the recovery by the department of the cost incurred, have to report that to SAP. And also in terms of the Prevention and Combating of Corrupt Activities Act, there is a requirement that where there is an individual who has, you know, fraudulently or stolen an amount exceeding 100,000 rand, criminal cases have to be preferred.
And then the accounting officer also is mandated to report those kind of cases also to SAPS. So it's not the end of it after the recovery of money. Criminal cases, in certain cases also, as you can see in the report, are also taking place where amounts, huge amounts are involved. And then in relation to, I think two issues that the Honorable Smith raised were issues that you're wanting the Public Service Commission to look into for our further report, that we will look into the breaking down and where we talk about amounts, cases that have been reported, that in the next report we need to indicate how many individuals have been involved. I think we have noted that. We will look into that in our next reporting case.
Thank you, Commissioner. I just want to raise the very first point that the Honourable Member made about whether education officials with misconduct is not showing a bad light for the education department when the misconduct is really on the social development department. But you must remember ensuring a particular ethical fibre of the public servant is that particular department. So the Department of Education is responsible for the promotion of ethics amongst its officials. And if so many of its officials display this kind of problem around ethics, I think it's not only the department against which they display this unethical conduct, but also the very fibre of that particular official within that department. So I think there's another aspect to that particular situation I would submit. The issue around...
Sorry, Che. No, I agree with you. I just think you understood me wrong. The way I thought that the many cases were actually cases in the department itself, not the officials of the department, if you understand what I'm saying. So that it looks a bit better, but now it's better the way you put it. Thanks.
There's also been a question about, can't we give individual reports for the departments? I think the Public Service Commission would love to be in that kind of position. I think we should be in a position very similar to what happens with what the Auditor General does in relation to financial reports. We should be in a position to be able to give governance reports in respect of each department. Because if you look at the research we do, that is very possible. However, if you look at our resources, we're completely unable to do that. But I think what we can assist in the sense that we do have the raw data in respect of every department. And should you be wanting to call a particular department and you're wanting us to zoom into this information, we are in a position to maybe lift that information up for you. But because of our limited resources, we're really not in a position to bring out individual reports per department. I think just an issue around our resources, because our allocation for 2008-2009, we actually got no increase from Treasury. And our department, or the Office of the Public Service Commission, which needs to cover the whole public administration, is smaller than the AG's office in the Western Cape. This is just to give you an idea or an indication of the kind of resources we're trying to stretch across an overview on oversight on public administration. In relation to the recovery aspect, as Commissioner Mashego has said, is really just one step in the process. But the fact of the disciplinary proceedings, that must still take place. And to the end that it's concluded, that really is the responsibility of the department. The one issue we must accept, and people may say, why there seems to be not sufficient number of these cases being criminally investigations launched against them. And I must say there is ambiguity in the legislation which allows for that kind of almost, if you will, cases of discretion. Because if you look in the Treasury regulations, it says any issue where there's a criminal connotation, regardless how small that amount is, that must be reported to the South African Police Service. However, if you go to the Corrupt Activities Act, it says any amount over 100,000. So I think because of that kind of ambiguity around the legislation, I think departments then believe that they've got a fair amount of flexibility and discretion in relation to what they should report or which amounts they should report. And definitely there's a tightening that's needed to ensure that abdication doesn't come around because of really ambiguity in the legislation. The 36%.
Let's have it on that very point. I agree 100% with what the DG is saying. However, I thought that the Supreme Act in terms of taxpayers' money was the PFMA. I thought that was the Supreme Act. And the PFMA says that where these things are found, the DG is duty-bound, or the accounting officer is duty-bound to do something about it. And that is why I was asking for individual reports, because I think that when we put pressure on the accounting officer, that accounting officer will be duty-bound to deal with these matters and get rid of that ambiguity. Because if we threaten to criminally, because it allows us to criminally charge the accounting officer, it will force the public service to deal with that ambiguity that's there. I think maybe that's the message that you must send, and that's certainly the message that we're going to send. And just to piggyback, and I'm not going to ask any more questions after this, Chair, we welcome the fact that you can zoom in. My question just is, how much lead time do you need? You know, we have about 2 weeks, I think, in our planning. If we came to you today and said we are interrogating defense in 2 weeks' time, is that sufficient lead time for you to give us some raw data on defense? That's just the question I'm asking, because that's how it's going to happen in practice.
Maybe just to quickly respond to that, in relation to a published report, we would already have that existing data. So a two-week lead-in would give us sufficient time, but not if you're talking about a more current year. I think that would have to be the what you'd have to consider, because if you want a much more current year, then we would have to go to the department to find out more information. But if the report is already published, a two-week lead-in shouldn't be a problem in terms of providing that information. I think in terms of the other question that the Honourable Member Smith had asked.
I'll give you an opportunity.
Actually, I just wanted on this particular issue that Vincent raised now, so we can conclude it.
All right. Okay.
You see, the PFMA is very clear. If you look at misconduct by an accounting officer, part of that misconduct is ignoring the provisions of Sections 38 to 42 of the PFMA. And the PFMA is very clear. They not only have to take action, Section 38 says, must take action, but it also says, in terms of Section 40.2b, must report. So that solves your problem in terms of accounting officers that are not cooperating with you in terms of giving you accurate information. And it's a case of that they must report, and it sets it all out there. Material losses, criminal discipline, it sets the whole lot. So you've got a very powerful act of parliament here to actually discipline an accounting officer that doesn't cooperate with you. The other questions we can come back to. The one maybe it relates to one that I asked previously is, are we getting soft because you see this decline on actual dismissal of people by about 50%? Huge decline over the last. People just don't get dismissed. I think it all ties together. I'm just trying to be helpful. I think you've got a very strong case, because this is critically important to the work you did.
Chair, what the Honourable Member says is noted, but I think apart from just the ambiguity, there's elements of complexity that we must look at. For example, if gross negligence falls under financial misconduct, maybe there's something wrong to some degree with the broadness of the definition. Because if an official loses a flash disk, which maybe costs 500 rand, as an accounting officer, I would want to charge that official for gross negligence. It will then fall under a finalized case for financial misconduct. But the likelihood of me going to report that official to the South African Police Services is completely unlikely. Even I'm possibly not going to follow that there, even though your PFMA is saying that really needs to be followed. So I think there's also problems around the definition of financial misconduct to some degree. Because if you report everything to the South African Police Service, with the challenges that even that particular service department is having, we've got to start being much more practical in relation to how we navigate some of this financial misconduct. I'm not by any means preaching that we must turn a blind eye in respect of it, but I'm not so sure how helpful or useful will it be with all the kind of service delivery challenges that we're facing if amounts of 100 Rand, 200 Rand are all reported to the South African Police Service. These are some of the issues we need to debate even further, I believe.
All right. Okay. Rapuli? Just a minute.
The question about whether we're getting too soft or not, I think it's in line with what the Honourable Member Smith spoke about, the 36% on your final written warnings. Does it mean that only 36% people were found guilty? No, actually 83% of the cases, the people were found guilty. Of that 83%, 36% got a written final warning. And then the question is asked, is that appropriate? And clearly, that is a question that needs to really be looked into. Because, especially around fraud and theft cases, if you're giving a situation of a final written warning, fraud and theft goes to the heart of the trust relationship between the employee and the employer. And if that trust is broken down, and in most cases your courts have said, where fraud and theft occurs, the trust relationship has broken down so irretrievably that it cannot be restored. But I think what we say, what is happening in the public service and what managers are saying, well, actually that trust relationship has not been damaged to that extent, and we're giving people a final written warning and they can continue with their jobs. That's the message we're sending out as managers. And whether that is the correct message is really something we need to engage with. And as it begs the question that if that's the message we're sending out, are we not then being tolerant to this particular, are we not being too soft in relation to it? Because we must be careful as management in terms of the message we're sending out, not only to our employees, to the public service as a whole, and to the public as well, and the kinds of perceptions that arise as a result. Thank you, Chair.
Yeah, it has been brought to my attention that the Public Account Committee is accompanied by the Ambassador. Ambassador Rafta, welcome. Right, Rapule?
Thank you, Chairperson. This one is perhaps more of a general impression question about the public service. If the question is unfair, please don't answer it. You know, the perception that is there about the public servants is that there are two schools of thought. One school of thought is that lack of delivery is because of lack of skills. Another school of thought is lack of delivery is because of these corruption cases and frauds and all those other things. How would we balance these two schools of thought? Because it might not necessarily be because of corruption that there is no delivery. How would we be helped to correct, you know, these perceptions?
Possibly a quick response to that is really to say the capacity challenges facing the public service are really multifaceted. It covers, as you say, these kind of extremes with an issue of scarce skills, lack of skills, levels of competency, but also the elements of corrupt public servants. I would want to encourage this committee to perhaps call us to engage on our State of the Public Service report. Our 2006 State of the Public Service report actually dealt with the theme of the challenges, the capacity challenges within the public service. And we looked at all the 9 values of what a good public service is supposed to be like. And we saw what were the challenges that were preventing or hindering the achievement of those values to their optimum. So I would really encourage that kind of engagement. If you look at what our most recent report is saying, and this is a report that actually looked at, has given a midterm review of government, if you will, and it really says that if you look in the area of the promotion of ethics and of anti-corruption, really there needs to be some dramatic intervention in actually throwing resources at investigative capacity, because there's no investigative capacity out there. If you look at our National Anti-Corruption Hotline, it's become a powerful participatory mechanism for the public to assist government in actually fighting corruption. However, the extent to which those cases are being investigated will very soon start undermining that very powerful instrument. Because at the moment, we're sitting with a feedback rate of only 36% of the cases that have come through that line. And clearly we need a much more dramatic intervention to ensure that the investigative arm of departments is strengthened if we're not going to undermine the credibility of those kind of mechanisms. And as I said, it's a much broader question, Honourable Member. And then we have the information that we've researched which we can engage with.
Would it be pushing it a bit too far to say that the challenges around being about the investigative capacities of departments may be in part informed by the response rate that you spoke to need to be located at the poor monitoring that takes place within departments and entities. That is, you have this problem. As the Honorable Trent indicated, the high level of incidences of financial misconduct in the lower level might actually be reflective of the lack of proper supervision and monitoring, which then leads to officials not complying with the laws and regulations. That is, you have case of non-compliance as a reflection of poor management and monitoring. And this will again reflect itself when cases are reported. I mean, the same fellow who is not managing properly would equally be not very enthusiastic in terms of investigating non-compliance. So it takes you back to our managers managing effectively and efficiently or not. I was putting a comment as a question whether that would be stretching it too far, but for me I see a direct relationship between these aspects, the high levels of high incidence of financial misconduct at the lower levels vis-a-vis proper management and monitoring by senior management, as well as the responses to reported cases of corruption through the hotline.
I would say that kind of correlation is not far-reached. You're correct. Good leadership should also ensure adherence to compliance. And if let's even take it another step. Currently, if you look at what's happening to the senior management services in the South African public service and the whole issue around compliance, I'm talking about compliance in terms of your personal issues that you need to comply with. The issue of financial disclosure, we have yet to receive 100% financial disclosure record since that has been introduced in 2002. So if senior managers are not filing their financial disclosure records, You can believe that there may be some kind of rippling effect that is happening in relation to the kind of internal monitoring controls and compliance rates they're imposing on their own officials. I think the same correlation can be made in respect of our performance agreement. I mean, the concern is such that the President had to elevate it in his State of the Nation address. Senior members are not all filling in their performance agreement. So if you have those kind of problems around compliance at that particular level, of course you're going to see the kind of findings you're seeing in terms of financial misconduct in terms of the lower levels within the public service. And therefore, I think all these issues are interrelated in some way. And senior management must be indicted to some degree in terms of what they are doing in terms of improving the situation. And we must stand accountable for that.
Okay. Just a minute, Honorable Trent, Comrade Bono.
Comrade Chair, maybe a cynical question, you know, but...
Just pull the mic towards you and talk into it.
Maybe a cynical question, but I must commend that the job, a very good job is done. I think it's well done and well articulated. But the cynical question is that if I only have problems with justice and constitution development and the Department of Defense, now those two are law enforcement kind of departments. Then you get again that you find that the provincial 47 departments have indicated that there's no financial misconduct. And then in the 14 departments in the national, no financial misconduct. Now, I know the limited resources that have stated here, and I just want to know how accurate can that be? Because if I'm head of the department, and I want to keep a clean slate, and is there any check up whether it's a true reflection or not?
I'm not sure if you actually got the question. Can you, may you repeat, comrade? Unfortunately, we...
Okay, let's cut it down. I just want to know, it says that in 35 national departments, 14 departments indicate that they finalize no financial misconduct. And 107 provincial departments, 47 departments indicate that there's no financial misconduct. I just want to know, how accurate is that? Because it seems, in this present day and time, it's so hard to believe. Thank you.
Did you repeat your comment? Was it a comment or a question on the fact that the two departments with high cases of financial misconduct are law, supposed to be law enforcement?
Yeah, well,
department.
I was just trying to say that the defense and constitutional... And the constitutional, Justice of the Constitutional Development said that there's problems there, there's a lot of misconduct there. But you find that the other departments from provincial, 47 in provincial and 40 in the national, they're clean slate like. There's no problems. I just want to know, is there any follow up to see whether that is a true reflection or not?
Thank you, Chair. As Nadia has already indicated, to a certain extent, we rely on the information as provided by the department. We have our own database where we look at what they provided in the previous cycle to try and compare that with what they are providing in the, a particular cycle, and we check that. And we do follow up with the department to check on the accuracy of what they have provided us. So in terms of being 100% sure, that can never be. But to the extent that we can, we do that. And in the current cycle now, what we've improved in terms of methodology is that we will do in local inspections on some of the departments where we have reason to think that there might be misleading or unreliable steps provided. So internally we're improving our methodology in order to verify, but part of what we get, really, we have to believe that departments are providing us quality input.
Thanks. I wanted to raise it earlier on, but I forgot about it. This committee is struggling with the, if you want to call it, revolving door or recycling. You know, you get a civil servant working in justice, messes up in justice, and then moves to the next department the next year. Now, if you take that with the written final warning, if I get a final warning in justice, chances are I'll apply for a job somewhere else. So my request to you is, no. Then in the last comment, oh yeah, how probable is it for a system of blacklisting? In other words, if Vincent has found to be inadequate in a department, how probable is it for us to blacklist that individual from ever working in the civil service again? Is it probable? And that was my request to you. Are we able to track these people? Because the reality is, many of them mess up in one department, do the same in the next department, and continue to work in the civil service. Now when we have the single civil service legislation or policy coming into place, it's going to make it even worse, Chair. I'm a DG, I mess up, next year I'll become the city manager of Johannesburg. So this revolving recycling thing is going to become critical. Are you guys able to do some investigation for us so that we can influence some sort of procedure or policy? Thanks.
A database of what?
Chair, the Honourable Member actually hits on a point that has concerned the Public Service Commission for some time. And when it came to a head was really during the time of the amendment of the Public Service Act. The Public Service Commission actually went on record to object to that particular element of the amended Public Service Act. Because you will know, with the 1994 Public Service Act, if I have misconducted myself or alleged that I've transgressed or misconducted myself in a particular department, if I tried to resign before those disciplinary hearings was concluded, I was deemed to have been discharged as a result of misconduct. So that's the choice I take, and I go out of the service. In the current legislation, I can actually be charged for misconduct. Before the hearing actually happens, I apply for another department. And that department then just accepts it and records it as a resignation. And so it's really also about how we tighten up some of our legislation as well. But this is a concern problem because there's no central database of, you know, we have a central database for investigating officers, for presiding officers, but we actually have no central database that actually shows that the number of people who have been discharged from the public service. In fact, it's so bad that before there was a way in which per cell, if they put in a particular, if they put in your ID, they would be able to say your per cell number has been discontinued because of discharge. My understanding, and I'm not completely, totally sure about this, but my understanding that doesn't happen anymore, or that kind of facility or function is not in play anymore. But these are the issues that could possibly help with those kind of situations. And of course, underpinning and underlying all of this here is just how effective the performance management system is being used. Because what is happening in the public service in some instances, people or managers may find it very difficult to deal with a problem employee or an employee that's not performing. That employee will then apply for a position in another department. The manager in that department would say, well, let me phone Mr. X or Ms. X to get a check, a reference check on this person. And because I want to get rid of the problem,
thank you. get their name.
Yeah, okay. Actually, looks like Mr. Honourable Trent, but he's not usually sitting there. Honourable Trent right now is sitting next to Honourable Poole.
And he's just moved there. Honourable Trent.
Yeah.
Trent, yes. Mm. And the one with the black jacket and slightly receding hair.
Herbert. Yes. Yeah, Herbert, yes. I'm going to ask the chairman if I put this knife. I'm going to ask the chairman if I put this knife in, actually.
Oh,
thank you.
Okay.
Hello? Is it any better? It doesn't look like it's any better.
Daniel, welcome. Continue to report the news. 2 o'clock. More committee rooms available. Because this is exactly what it is. Huh? I don't know when I find that.
No. There is a there is a committee room that they are going to check. Just to confirm. Right, comrades, I think we'll have to move to V226, the old assembly. Please, V226.
much delay, we can now continue. And our sincerest apologies to officials and also our guests.
Followed by
salary level 6 and 7, and those are the figures. Who are the people, or what are their ages, the persons that are responsible for microlending debt are the age group between 40 and 49, and between 50 and 59. Those are the people that pay the highest amount, and that is 6.6 and 6.3 million respectively during the financial year 2006-2007. The two age groups are collectively responsible for more than three quarters, and that is 77% of all payments in microlenders. If we look at the numbers of the people, how many people actually make this microlending payment, a total of 4,063 public servants made payments to microlenders through PERSOL, and that is the distribution then in terms of where these people are employed, whether they're at national or provincial. So you will see that 68% of these payments came from provincial departments. The highest number, that is 1,381, is attributed to persons employed in the occupational category, other occupations. And that, honorable members, this talks to the parity of the data that is provided or updated on PERSOL. We would not be sitting with this kind of set if departments took the time to accurately update PERSOL and say what occupational categories these people are. So that means it also has implications for the reporting that we do. The SEP has recorded the highest number of people that have made microlending payments, and that is 843, and that is followed by the occupational category cleaners, and then nursing at the number of 226. Of the total, then, of the public servants who've made payments to microlenders, 53% are male and 47% female. The percentage of females who made payments is lower than the overall percentage of females employed in the public service, as females have a higher representation in the public service compared to male public servants. It appears then that they tend to exercise more restraint in respect of the microlending practices compared to male. So if we take into account the fact that there are females in the public service, the trend should be that females have paid more than the reverse holds true. The majority of the 4,063 public servants who made payments to microlenders, as I said, occupied salary level 7, and that is 1,165. The majority of public servants who made payments to microlenders also fall within the age group of 40 to 49, and followed by the age group 50 to 59. Moving on now to the issue of country orders. The total cost of payments that are made as a result of country orders that have been published to public servants amounted to 1.01 billion during the 2006-07 financial year. And that is the distribution rate as to the amount. As you will see, provincial is sitting at 726 million, which is 7% of the payments that have been made. If we look at the gender representation in terms of the amount that have been paid, you will see then that males paid the larger percentage of 64, because the figures are standing at 538 million for males and 473 million for females. Public servants on salary level 7 accounted for the largest amount of payment made to country debt, and that is 269 million. If we look at the number of public servants who made Ganeshi-related payments during the 6-7 financial year, the total there is that there are 216,867 public servants who made Ganeshi-related payments to PERSOL, and that would account for about 20% of the total number of public servants. So 20% of people in the public service have paid Ganeshi-related payments. 54% of the public servants who made Ganeshi-related payments were male, and 47% were female. And 25% of public servants who made Ganeshi-related payments were on salary level 7. The section
highest number of payments were made by a public servant at salary level 6, that is 23,999, and those are followed by those at salary level 8. So similar to the payments that you've seen at micro lending, it's found that the majority of public servants who made those Ganeshi-related payments, that is 98,407, which accounts for 45%, were within that age group that I talked about earlier of 40 to 49. The highest number of public servants who made Ganeshi-related payments is those in the occupational field, other occupations. I've already talked about the implications of that. And then note further that SEP recorded the second highest number of Ganeshi related payments, and that is 27,663 people, members of the SEP, have made Ganeshi related payments in the year 2006-07. While professions such as, or people such as prosecutors, youth workers, and social workers, have paid the lowest number of Ganeshi related payments. Now, what are the implications of all the statistics? What are the implications of the information that it is received? For the public service as an employer, it creates an administrative burden. The capturing of Ganeshi orders on personal cases an additional stress on the administrative capacity. And given the 218 and 121 public servants who made Ganeshi-related payments to the 6-7, there's a possibility then that national and provincial departments are really experiencing a level of administrative burden in this regard. If we look at ill health through financial distress, financial difficulties among the loan causes of stress and anxiety. So if a person already suffers from one or other type of illness, financial distress would worsen her condition or his condition and would result in the employee being away from work for an extended period and better implications. So persons who are affected by micro-lending debt and especially Ganeshi orders will tend to get sick more often than persons who are affected by such programs. And given the rate of indebtedness and the high cost of guarantees issued against public servants, the situation regarding ill health, particularly financial distress, within the public service really is cause for concern. If we look at 54% of public servants who make guarantee-related payments, again, these were male and 47 were female, and again, the issue of the salary level 7, 25% of public services made Ganeshi orders, Ganeshi-related payments were on salary level 7, and this correlates with the fact that public servants at this level have also made a lot of payments to micro-lenders. The highest second number of payments made by public servants at salary level 6, and followed by those at salary level 8. So similar to the payments made to micro-lenders, it is found that the majority of public servants who made Ganeshi-related payments were within that age group again. The highest number of public servants, that is 79,360, who made Ganeshi-related payments are those in the occupational field. I've already talked about how that impacts on the quality of our reporting. If we look at the issue of irregular remunerative work outside of the public service, that is AROP. You'll note, honorable members, that public servants who engage in AROP do so with a view to source additional income. So while engagement in AROP cannot be attributed to one particular reason, the need to service debt or ease the level of indebtedness cannot be ruled out. So although the public service has regulatory provisions in this regard, some public servants continue to carry out AROP without complying with the regulatory framework that's in place. And the latter was confirmed through the previous studies of the TSC. And if you look at the report in the housing province, as well as the management of public servants elected as municipal councils in the Kopa and the Western provinces, we're well aware of the issues around AROPs and the irregular AROPs that is performed.
uniforms within the public service. The fatigue and stress that is associated with holding two jobs at the same time is likely to impact negatively on the state's capacity to deliver the services at a level delivery mandate. If we look at the ethical considerations, by virtue of being the first constitutional principle under Section 195 of the Constitution of South Africa, there's a clear intention by policymakers to place emphasis on professional ethical conduct within the public service. So to ensure that this is achieved, public servants have a responsibility then to ensure that during the performance of their duties and within the outside of the workplace, they conduct themselves in a manner that promotes ethical conduct. A sound framework has been instituted to promote a strong culture of ethics within the public service. However, the over-indebtedness of public service could result in an erosion of the ethics among public servants, as they would then be enticed to commit unethical or corrupt practices by accepting bribes and committing fraud as a remedy to their financial strife or doing irregular hours of business, just stated at the moment. If we look at the recommendations, departments should ensure that information is provided in line with the health data flows to avoid the creation of supplementary data fields such as other or unknown every application for reporting. And then a fully fledged EAP should be embarked upon. And that will look into personal finances, financial wellness, with a key focus on the legislative framework on micro-lending, the procedure for the issuing of guarantee orders, credit rights, and budgeting, borrowing, saving, and how this can all be managed effectively. The implementation of the ethical framework in place should be strengthened, because there is a good ethical framework that is in place. It has to be implemented and monitored effectively to be useful. And departments are to keep abreast on the level of indebtedness of employees through the continuous monitoring of the records relating to micro-lending, debt repayment, and guarantee orders that are issued. If we look at the policy framework around disclosure of financial interest, it should be amended to include such aspects of debt, the nature of the debt and the credit cards that are involved. The financial disclosure framework for the SMS should be amended to also include information on liabilities to ensure an overall assessment of a public service financial institution. As it stands now, public servants do give information on their assets and their interests, but there's a bit of a gap there in that it does not make provision for them to provide information on their debt, and that should be seriously considered. In order to alleviate the challenges experienced by the affected public servants, it is recommended that the accounting officers of departments must comply with paragraph 23 of the Treasury Regulations, which among other things states that after the deduction, the official will have sufficient means for maintenance for him or herself and any dependents. It is not unheard of that in some instances, after all the guarantee orders have been effected, then the person is left with nothing to sustain themselves for the month, and that is an untenable situation. Now, if we then take a moment then to look at the parallels that can be drawn between these two reports. We will look that in terms of the distribution of financial misconduct cases, 64% of these are found in the provincial departments and then 36% at national departments. If we look at micro-lenders, we will see that the distribution of payments that are made to micro-lenders, 68% of these are made at provincial departments and 32% at national departments. If we look at guarantee orders, there are 77% aside with the provincial departments and 23% with the national departments. If we look then at the highest number of financial misconduct cases, as you're well aware, those fall between the levels of salary level 6 and 7. And in terms of the...
Just a minute, just to note that we understand that
visitors are leaving, take a tour of Parliament. I think that's an order. We'll meet you later.
Thank you.
Chair, thank you. Chair, I've got a couple of questions. My first one is basically dealing with the whole issue of microlending. The whole microlending industry, as far as I can remember, is a very young industry in South Africa, if you compare it to the other banking industries. And I just wondered, you know, microlending, the way that we experience it on the ground, is very much similar to the DOP system. You know, once you're in it, you can't get out of it. And I'm just wondering, whose wisdom was it to allow microlenders to borrow to civil servants and then the money being deducted from their salaries? Because I really think this is quite an unholy practice. Maybe there's an answer in terms of legislation that you can't stop it, but I'm sure, I think one should have a look at this. Because once someone is into microloans, I've met very few people that eventually get out of it. And I think we're not helping our civil servants regarding that. The other question, if I may, Chair, is if I take you to page 21 of this report, and also page 34, it gives a breakdown of the number of people in the various departments who got problems with these micro lending,
and also with a garnishee-related payment. Now, obviously, these departments have got varies in terms of numbers of employees. But it is quite frightening that if you look at the figures, at the micro-lending one, it stands out that your nursing assistants, your professional nurses, your staff and nurses, and also your SAPs, and if you look at the 24, on page 24, I mean page 34, sorry, again, your garnishee orders, the highest enormous amount of people is the ambulance-related jobs, biochemistry, then there's health, science-related, nursing assistant, 6,652. Your police, 27,000. Professional nurses on page 37, 6,060. On the same page, staff nurses and pupil nurses, 3,828. If you compare that to the other departments, surely, I mean, we cannot say that nurses and the police don't know how to manage their finance. That's wrong. Isn't there something seriously wrong with the amount of money that we are paying the people in this field, that they basically can't get out with their finances, and that eventually leads them to financial problems? And if there's a possibility of this, then has this been taken up by the PSC with the relevant ministries? Thank you, Joe.
Chair, which button works here? This one.
Chair,
Pierre has basically covered me with his last question, but I just wanted to then ask, because of the highest is at 6, 7, and 8, and you find exactly the same, as you said, in terms of the financial, there's a reason there. Now, my question is, do civil servants in the different departments at the different levels earn comparable salary? And I think that relates to what Pierre is saying. You know, obviously your policemen and the detectives and these people would fall into that, as so would the professional nurses and police. So, you know, that maybe tells us a very, very important story, that in some departments maybe clearly people are not earning comparable salaries with other departments. And then the other question I ask is that if you look at Pierre's question on micro-lending, this is just about scoppers or micro-lenders, and I'm very aware of what he said, how true it is. What about indebtedness to commercial banks and high purchase? Because if you look at people who are earning fairly good salaries, the banks look at what you can afford to pay off, and they will lend you money to buy a motor car on that basis. They don't really know how much you owe a micro-lender, because you can hide that from them. And so, in other words, the situation might be even worse. And I just wondered what, you know, your comment on that particular one. I think it would be so easy to get that information from the banks, maybe. I'm not sure. You take your ID, they confiscate it.
Well, he's a financially healthy, wise man. He doesn't know.
He's a financial wise man.
Yeah.
So he doesn't know what a micro-lender is.
He doesn't know what a micro-lender.
All right, they'll report to that.
Thank you, Chairman and honorable members. Just in relation to the questions, the first one, the micro-lending industry, who authorizes it to, is there any legislation that authorizes it for public servants to borrow from it? And whether there is any legislation that authorizes the employer to deduct money from the public servants. On the first part, I'm not checking the DG, we will talk to that today. In terms of, I think when people want to borrow money, they can go to whatever source that will be able to borrow money. I don't think that's a matter of regulation, and it also depends on your debt appetite, and also maybe your financial status. But just from personal experience, I think maybe many people who cannot afford to get loans from the banks, those are the ones that go to microlending. The only disadvantage is that the microlending will confiscate your ID documents, etc., and may use other means, you know, other than legal ones to get money from yourself. And as far as it relates to the employer, this is now when you are over indebted and you are not able to service the debt in terms of the arrangements that have been made prior to the loan being granted to you. And now the Ghanese order sort of like mandates the employer to deduct the amount so that you are able to service the debt. However, as the presenter indicated, in terms of the Public Finance Management Act, the Public Finance Management or Treasury Regulations, the accounting officer has to make sure that the employee still has money to sustain themselves and their families. So you don't have to deduct the whole amount and make sure that there is nothing to take home, as sometimes is the case. So these are the issues that the employer needs to look into. Hence, we are saying that the implications for the public service is that there is, you know, an exerted over-administrative burden for the employer to be able to monitor this. And then in terms of the breakdown and the prevalences between the nurses and the members of the staff, who in terms of our records are the ones that are servicing microlenders or also make Ghanese-related payments, and whether this is an issue of them maybe not being adequately remunerated. I know that in terms of the Minister for Public Service and Administration, there is occupation-related increment that is now going to take place for the nurses. I'm not sure whether this is the case with the police. But there is a perception out there that they are the ones that receive very limited, you know, salaries. And then in terms of the comparative salaries, I think the DG will be able to speak more adequately to this.
Thank you, Chair. I think, Justine, there's an interesting question that was asked about, you know, how does Purcell actually present itself as a service for microlending? Mm. And I think that also got, to some degree, some institutional memory, and some of the public servants that have been longer will attest to this there. But my understanding, there was a stage where Treasury had come out with an instruction that no deduction should happen in terms of Purcell that has got nothing to do with the employer. In other words, those deductions also then related to issues of insurance, your car, etc. And I think because they realized some of the practical difficulties in terms of administering such your motor vehicle finance, etc., I think this loop then came back in. But I think we really need to understand it much more as to how that happened. Because if you remember before, things like social clubs, burial policies, you could use your Purcell system or your salary administration system for all of that. And I know there was an attempt to actually move that all out of the system. How some of these actually came back into the system, I think it's something that we need to investigate. But there is an evolution of thoughts around, because there was a recognition of this administrative burden in relation to that. The issue around the occupational categories that are indebted and the emphasis around the teachers and the nurses, definitely a matter of concern. And our report raises the issue that the issue around salaries is something that could be impacting upon this. But I think in fairness, we must remember we did not do an evaluation on the conditions of services of these categories. So I could not say definitively that could be the problem. I think, you know, for us to be able to give credible research, we would have to do an analysis around those conditions of service. But I think the more interesting question and what I thought would come out and what members would ask is, where's teachers in all of this? Because if we go back to our own communities and if we see what has happened over time, remember, I mean, when I was in primary school, the teachers were living in the best, in my community, the teachers were living in the best houses, the teachers were driving the best cars. Now when I go back to that same community, the teachers are quite low down on the rent. They're driving the worst cars, their houses are, you know, their problems look problematic. And we think that that occupational category, we have not known, is the occupational category where you find the most of your teachers. And until there's a clean up around the information on personnel, I think you'd also find some frightening aspects around not just nurses and police officials, but also your teaching fraternity as well. That's what we suspect in relation to the information. In the area about, and of course your issue around cleanness, I mean that, if you look at it, that's one of the categories that really, people at that level are really hard pressed. And it must be to a large degree in that particular level also the issue of finances and the way in which that levels are being remunerated. The issue about whether there's different levels and different salaries among civil servants, we have a 16 salary level. And within that 16 salary level grading as such, you can have different job evaluation gradings that come up. Let me give you a more personal example to the Public Service Commission. And this then leads to this whole question about how the EQUATE system happens. The EQUATE system is actually the system which evaluates jobs according to a job description. 2 years back, all the deputy directors reporting to the Public Service Commission were on level 11. If you looked at all the almost 90% of deputy directors in all the other departments, those deputy directors were on level 12. So as a result, we had a problem retaining people at that level. Mm-hmm. So people weren't going for a promotion, but were actually moving to departments because they were graded better. And the problem with that kind of grading was the EQUATE system was actually biased towards the number of people you're supervising rather than the kind of depth that you need to be a specialist. And therefore, officials within the PSC who were doing all the research work were to some degree prejudiced. So we went back to that job description, and the way in which you load that job description will determine what the outcome of that job description. I've successfully now got an outcome of salary level 12. Now you can imagine other departments actually doing all these things, but perhaps for different reasons. And within that situation, you could get different salary levels, if you want. But that is, and it's the way in which the EQUATE system actually lands itself. You're right. I mean, this report only talks about micro-lending, and this report talks about garnishee orders. But we can, in the room alone, I'm indebted to the bank for my bond installment, for my car allowance. Yeah. I may not be paying through a micro-lender. I may not reach the stage where a garnishee order has been, but I definitely can't say I'm free from debt. But, you know, to the extent in which the issue here is not whether or not we have debt, because everybody must have debt. The issue is whether or not I can manage
debt.
Because my personal management or my personal finances, if I don't do that properly, how can I be expected to manage the state resources properly? And I think that's the real message out of this report. Not so much the issue of debt, but how the issue of ill discipline around financial management could impact on the way in which we manage the resources of the state.
Okay. Just to follow up on, I was fascinated by your description of how you can change the levels, and I can see that, but I think the problem that you would get is, and that's where we perhaps come to the nursing profession and staffs and, as you said, teachers, you would think. For a department to do that, in SAPS, would cost them a fortune because you're looking at volumes of people. And you know, so I think that is the problem. So maybe one's got to have a re-look at, you know, this whole thing. Just to something interesting, and you asked where the micro-lending comes from. When I was in the Eastern Cape 14 years ago. It was most of the staff was on the micro lenders. And there was a huge lobby from that industry, political lobby, to say, come on, these people are reneging on their payments, help us. And in fact, one of our senior civil servants was fired because he actually instituted the system of deducting the money from them. So, you know, I think that it's a very unwise situation because you actually are encouraging an industry which I believe exploits people. I mean, the interest rates they charge are appalling.
It's criminal.
I mean, I get people phoning me all day long, what can Parliament do about... No, I'm serious. I mean, I get lobbied to stop it. And I know other people get lobbied to keep it going because it's the microlenders to have this, this recourse to get their money. So I think it's very, very serious.
All right.
Yeah, just that comment on it.
Well, you can say that the micro-lender is at the primitive accumulation stage. They are very bad.
Yeah.
Highly educated. They have not yet treated the sophistication of the bank.
Thank you. Just clarity. So paragraph 3.1 indicates that 30.3 million rand that was deducted from the personal system. 13.3 million out of 3.1. Now, I don't know how accurate this figure, but we normally bandy about that there are about a million public servants.
Yeah,
1.2. You know, if we do a rough calculation, it means that's the worst case scenario. This talks about not all the civil servants, it talks about certain levels, but let's assume we talk about all the civil servants. It means it's almost a million rand a person. Is that what we say?
Mm-hmm.
No.
Mm-hmm.
There's a million people.
1.2.
We owe 13 million rand. Or we deducted 30 million. Yes, I'm just talking about a rough average. I'm saying it could be more for some people and less for other people, but I'm saying just looking at the global figures. That sounds correct.
Mm.
If there are a million people,
right?
No.
We deducted 13 million.
No, then it's 13 rand each.
13 rand each.
13 rand, yes. 13, not your.
Oh, okay. Right.
It's pocket money.
I was getting very old. So it's 13 rand.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. No, that's fine.
Still a lot of
money. That can't be right.
If you don't have it,
that can't be right. The poorest people are overnight.
This was the worst case scenario. Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
Well, I think that again, if you look at when you are making a comparison to the previous report, in terms of the provincial department of the national, in terms of financial misconduct, there is some correlation. When you look at the level, salary level, you find that there is still some correlation. But what I'm not getting is in the previous report, the Department of Justice and Coastal Development, as well as SANDF, had the highest percentage of financial misconduct. But when you come to the data, that does not come through, unless if we are victims of the other occupation, which then does not allow us to. Because I'm looking at the police. We have 17 cases of financial mismanagement. But in terms of indebtedness, people who are paying, who have had deductions done, the cash order, we have over 800. Now, what does it say? Looking at yourself, is there any direct correlation between financial mismanagement and the indebtedness of the public service?
Chairperson, might not be different from what you are saying because more of a global question. I discussed this thing, you know, when you are outside with some of the, with the BG and the lady, you know, about that. You know, the problem is more with culture than anything else. That, that is what I think. I was asking them whether there is counseling within the people, because there is this consumer-driven culture, you know, in South Africa.
Yeah.
And I think I was telling them perhaps we are too academic with handling problems rather than seeing what the root cause is. Because when you look at the spending trends in South Africa, civil servants, members of parliament, it doesn't depend upon how much you get and so on. But there is this, you know, there is just that spending. That is why, you know, the governor of the Reserve Bank would always be saying, tighten your belt lest we increase the reports and all those other things. So they were saying there is some programs within the public service that could otherwise, you know, cancel the public service. Not that much of a question of a salary. It is this culture that we have got to deal with, and I'm just wondering, perhaps they could share, you know, that with us, because I discussed that with them. I mean, as a parent, I know I've got children, and I know what is happening. You know. Today, my son was telling me, you see, he couldn't, ladies couldn't agree to be married by somebody who doesn't have a car, you know. And you see that? Then the only option was to get too much on his end. Try to buy a car. You see this type of thing, you see. I think it's more of a comment than a question.
I see. Okay. So some of these guys drive cars of their choice.
I'm a little more interested in the solutions that have been proposed by the Commission, which to me is very important, and we just go to that, your recommendations, which to me are very sound, specifically that you can't impose a garnishing order where the person clearly, you know, will get themselves into serious debt. Now, the question is, when, in terms of that regulation, must the accounting officer, whoever grants this or imposes it, must they look into the total indebtedness of the person? In other words, what they're paying on a home loan, you know, all of those things. Is that part of it? Is that a requirement? Because if that is a requirement, you might find that in many cases these garnishing orders might have to be reduced dramatically in order to comply with, you know, with that section. And then the other question is, in terms of the National Credit Act, would that not also be helpful? I know that doesn't affect the garnishing side of it, but the actual lending side. I don't know whether micro-lenders are also subject to that act. Well, they must be. And clearly that act has got to help, because you can't lend, you're basically not allowed to lend person money unless you're sure that they can actually afford it, I think, if I understand the act. And then finally, as in many things that I see in Parliament which frustrates me, is where do we go from here? You've made certain recommendations. What happens now? Does this come to the Public Service Standing Committee? Whatever. For action.
Just a comment on what Mr. Chenzo was saying, and maybe the guru would help me. My understanding was that garnishing orders were court orders, and therefore you have no right as DG to interfere with.
Yeah. Now, but just in terms of the actual regulations as to how what you've got to do before you implement it,
what I'm saying is if the court has said deduct 10 rand, we can't hear the legislation do anything differently. And then they would have to assist me in that regard. That's what I thought.
Okay.
The orders were.
The court, yeah. The court vis-a-vis the deed, yeah.
The court, the
yeah, 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 okay.
Yeah. they are the ones that have to do it. So I don't think there's much that the DC would be able to.
But then, just to follow, just that Vincent's question is clear.
My question, Chair, more than anything else, was this report, has it been distributed, or who has it been distributed to? You know, my fear is this thing comes to Parliament. Not even the ANC caucus is aware of this thing, because people just don't read it. And unless somebody physically champions it, it's not going to go there. So my recommendation, and certainly we can take this thing up, is that maybe this type of information needs to be marketed, distributed, whatever you have to call it, quite widely, because it's a serious matter. I mean, some of us will raise it in the caucus on Thursday, but the process on its own, chances are nobody would even open up this thing. So just a recommendation, whether it's in the civil service or within the politicians, I think we need to spread it.
All right, maybe before it goes, let's take comments here so that we
done. Chair, thank you. When you started your presentation on this indebtedness, you were referring to the garnishee orders resulting from microlending. But in this report, it doesn't split it. You know, it doesn't. It just speaks of garnishing orders in total. Now, and in the figure on page 26 is 1.01 billion rand garnishee orders. Now, what percentage of that 1.01 billion rand garnishee orders is the result of failure on microlending payments? Because that would also, if it's available, give us quite an idea of the defaulting on microlending.
Chair, can I just clarify my question? So, because Vincent and I are not at either, and we are on the same wavelength. But what I was saying is that this is what your recommendation says. I'm just reading it. It says, it is recommended that the accounting officers of departments comply with paragraph 23 of the Treasury Regulations. Right, that's the regulation in terms of a law. And then it goes on to say that they may not deduct more money than, they may not deduct so much that the person has nothing to live with. But now your point, what does that person do if the court has said you will deduct 1,000 rand a month or whatever? You know, then you get it, that's my question. How do we deal with that? Because the one seems to be a contradiction of the other. If it's in terms of a court order, obviously, which it must be. I got it, sure.
So if I could just respond to the very last question that has been raised by the two honorable members. In terms of the Treasury regulation, it does say that the accounting officer must make sure that the person is in a position to support themselves after those deductions have been made. In the, and the honorable member is right that it is a court order that has to be complied with. But then what the Treasury regulations say is that in complying with that court order, they must check the regularity of that order as to how it was obtained. That is the first inquiry. And the second thing is, in the event that they find that having, if they make that deduction, the person will be unable to carry the day-to-day expenses of his life, then they have a duty to advise the person as to what they can do to get that assistance. Because yes, it is a valid court order and it has to be complied with. But depending on the regularity of how it was obtained, a person can approach the court to get a rescission of that court order to make it affordable for the employee.
Yeah, so that's a process.
Yes.
Alright.
Chair, in the question you asked about whether there's a correlation between financial management and indebtedness, I think as the Public Service Commission is saying, we're saying there is definitely that correlation. What we're not so sure of is whether there is an exact correlation between financial misconduct and indebtedness. Because we see the correlation between financial management and indebtedness really underpinned by how the discipline around how you manage finance.
But the link between financial misconduct and indebtedness, I think that's a much more difficult link, and we haven't been able to conclusively say that there is that kind of clear nexus, if you will.
Yeah.
And I think the closest we came to was really seeing that what is happening in terms of the South African Police Service really seems to be that kind of tenuous correlation. But definitely, without, we can't say with certainty whether that is the case.
Mm.
Around the issue about the counseling programs within the public service, I think all departments must put in place an employee assistance program. And one of the components of such a program should be assisting around the financial wellness of public servants. Because, look, if you, most of these programs currently are geared towards HIV and AIDS, you know, people that are affected or infected with it, or alternatively, they're geared towards substance abuse. If you've got an employee who seems not to be able to handle the alcohol, you basically send them to the program. The extent to which these programs are assisting people to manage their finances have not been exploited to the extent they can. But I think what has happened quite recently is Treasury has actually contracted financial advisors who can then go into the department, and the service is actually free for the department as such, for these financial advisors to carry out the necessary workshops. So that could be possibly a positive way also of promoting the importance of actually showing some concern around the financial wellness of your employees, if you look at the implications they have to the public servant. Okay, and where do we go from here?
Yeah.
And that's always an interesting question, because at the end of the day, our primary stakeholder is Parliament. And as a public service commission, we position ourselves in a way which we say we are the actual technical oversight. At the end of the day, the political oversight comes from Parliament. What we can do as a public service commission is strengthen your arm to call people to account and to see whether this practice is happening or not. At the end, we really try to promote excellence in public administration. We don't have the enforceability to force departments to actually go in our direction. It's really at the discretion of heads of department, at the discretion of the executive, whether they want to follow our advice or not. And I think, and therein comes the role of committees such as yourself, the political oversight, and how do we actually influence policy and we influence practice in a way that you get these kind of positive results. It's also been linked to the issue of where are these reports distributed. Again, because of resources, our major thrust of publishing of these reports and presenting these reports are, first of all, to our critical stakeholders. Obviously, we also try to ensure that every head of department also gets a copy of this report. But that's not enough. Really, you need to advocate these reports. I mean, as the Honorable Member Smith says, if we didn't come to talk to these reports, this research is out there, but if it's not engaged on, it becomes very difficult. How do we deepen our advocacy? Trying to deepen that kind of advocacy role of the Public Service Commission is linked intricate, you know, it's closely linked to what resources we have available to us. Ideally, you'd want to make this presentation in every single department, in every province. We don't have the resources, whether they're human resources or financial resources. And therein has the difficulty that sometimes very useful research doesn't necessarily get the kind of impact you want, because it's not as widely taken out there, and therefore the awareness level and its potential to improve the public service is limited in that sense. So these are some of the constraints that we are faced with as an organization.
I would imagine, I said that we were ripping it up. I do imagine, I understand, I'm not sure whether I'm correct or not, that we have a forum where things will be. I'm not sure what things that you discuss, but if you are looking at the governance issues right across, certainly, for me, that will be the first thing that I can platform to
who are looking at you within the picture of getting, and be able to agree on programs and how this will be taken up by each department that is, you know, that is affected, among so many other things that can be done or that should be done. The same thing we say to Mr. Fraser. Find that there are these challenges recurring, which level of financial management, how do you communicate with your colleagues to ensure that their first of time financial management issues are somewhere among the top issues that you discuss. But the committee is at a time.
No, Chair, they haven't answered me if they have it available, the percentage of the garnishee total at 1.1 billion, what percentage, if it's available, is the result of default on micro lending payments, if it's available. If it's not available, it's not available.
See, not directly, although if you look at the way in which our report happens, we say a progression of debt actually happens. Micro lending is actually where you say you've used all kinds of the normal legal resources to now go into the next level. By the time you got to the garnishee, you even get to the loan shark. So we assume that it's really just another progressive level. So we think by the time you got to a garnishee order, you more than likely have gone through that micro lending first to try and stop that debt until you realize you can't breathe more anymore. But we haven't directly put that, except interpreted that within the context of a progression of it.
But thank you very much. Thank you very much for this interaction. It was indeed a very good interaction. I think for us, we should actually, in addition to how we do our work, the interaction that you said will probably also be for you. When the department coming from you, give us sense. I think for us that is a step forward to assist us in creating in terms of having a holistic
Who pays for lunch today?
Irish potatoes.
Irish potatoes.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.